This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Sigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 116th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have today with me, Doug Maughan. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Gary. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for joining us from Utah. Doug Maughan is CSD Division Director in HSARPA within the Science and Technology Directorate of the Department of Homeland Security. Doug directs cyber research and development at HSARPA. Prior to his work at DHS, Doug was at DARPA as a program manager in the Advanced Technology Office. I think I first met Doug when he was at DARPA. Doug also worked for the NSA as a senior computer scientist. Doug did his undergrad work at Utah State, earned a master's in CS from Johns Hopkins, and a PhD from UMBC. That's the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Doug lives in Maryland with his family, and he is currently calling in from southern Utah. So thanks for joining us, Doug.
Thanks again, Gary.
Let's talk about science and the important role that government funding plays in supporting academia and, you know, kind of hard-edge science. You spent time at DARPA, and now you're at HSARPA, funding mostly early-stage science and some, I guess, tech transfer activities. Which projects that you funded do you think were the most important over your career of doing this sort of thing?
I think there have been a lot of them have been, you know, significant. I think, for starters, probably the more impactful one that people don't actually see is some of the work we funded at DARPA, and we're doing some work in this area as well in distributed denial of service defense technology. So a company like Arbor Networks, which is still one of the, you know, staple companies for DDoS defense, was some based on work I funded 15, 16 years ago. Even though DDoS hasn't gone away, we've still made a pretty significant dent in the problem, and now it's getting, you know, it's kind of getting worse again, and we've started to fund some additional work in this area looking at solutions to defend against a DDoS to a 911 center or, you know, other critical infrastructure. So I think that's a key area that has impact on everyone.
Yeah, that's great. That's a perfect example. Anything else come to mind?
Well, you know, as you know, Gary, we've been behind the domain name system security and the DNSSEC initiative for the last decade. I think we're still waiting for the killer app for DNSSEC, but you know, we've gotten almost global, you know, understanding and a lot of deployment of DNS security. We're now doing very similar things with routing security, with the routing public key infrastructure and security for the Border Gateway Protocol, again, all of which is a global piece of cybersecurity that, you know, while everybody doesn't have to implement it, it does have global impact.
Yeah, and that's, I think, sort of invisible is the cool way of putting it.
It's, you know, just like the air and water, we kind of need security of cyberspace and people not even, you know, don't want them to even notice it.
So one of the biggest challenges that everybody in technology faces, who has even a pinky in science land, is this notion of tech transfer. So how, in your view, does tech transfer really work, and how long does it really take?
You know, that's, you know, learned a lot of lessons about tech transfer. I think what people don't understand is we often spend 80% of the money on the science and leave 10 or 20% to try to transition. And in fact, the work factor is about the exact opposite. It takes 20% of the work to do the science and the research, and it takes 80% of the work to actually transition it and commercialize it. It's a lot harder than people ever think, because there are so many aspects to transitioning and commercializing. One of the things that I think I learned at DARPA that I then transitioned over to DHS was this issue of transition, and most researchers don't think about transition until well down the the timeline of their research.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we did at DHS and have been doing for 12 years now is when we do solicitations, we require, again, at DHS, we're not really doing basic science. It's applied through transition, but when we do solicitations, we require a significant part of that proposal to be about the transition and what the commercial opportunities are. And that's a significant evaluation criteria, because if it doesn't have commercial potential and the ability to make it into the market, we're less likely to fund that research, because gone are the days of just funding research and having it sit on the shelf.
Yeah, that's interesting, but the real question is, if you have a good scientist, can they actually do tech transfer? Because, I know a lot of really excellent academics who publish great papers and they do great work, but I don't think that they could build a product to save their life or even pitch something to a VC. And so what do you do about that?
So, we've seen plenty of scientists who don't want to be entrepreneurs,
yeah,
and that's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a separate program we've initiated. It came out of the White House Comprehensive National Cybersecurity Initiative called Transition to Practice, where we have engaged with VCs, with angel funders, with incubators, and worked to bring technology out of the labs, out of the hands of the scientists, if they're not going to be an entrepreneur, and been able to license those technologies or make those technologies available for open source, such that we've been able to get the technologies out of the labs and into the market.
Is that sort of an InQtel model, kind of?
It's a little different than InQtel in the sense that we're still earlier stage when we're doing that compared to the InQtel model, which is a later stage approach.
Right. So let's talk about, what some people call the research valley of death. Do you think that the research valley of death is real? I mean, we've sort of been addressing it, so I think the answer is yes, but, what's your experience with that?
Yeah, it certainly is, and in fact, as I said, we oftentimes put way more money into the research piece than we do into the transition piece, and in fact, the harder part is that time frame between when you've done the research and you've done some development, but you've been unsuccessful in getting the technology more mature, getting the technology into pilots or red teamed or customer deployments, and people don't understand that that takes time, that takes a lot of work, and that's not research, and it's also they're not quite product yet either. So
yeah,
there's a fair amount of effort that needs to go in there, and that all takes a little bit of money too. So that's another thing we actively fund, is those kinds of activities to try to help the entrepreneur or the researcher along the commercialization path.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think you sat on the jury once or twice when we did Department of Commerce Advanced Technology Program stuff a million years ago at Cigital. And that was one way to get across the research valley of death, but it was politically difficult. In fact, some people called that corporate welfare, I remember. And the whole idea of, transitioning stuff from the lab to VCs came as a foreign thought, because they, people figure VCs would just pick up any shiny object and fund it, but that's just not the case.
That is not the case.
Yeah.
And they're not going to actually invest in those technologies that are in the valley of death. The VCs are only going to invest in the technologies
that crossed it,
that are just crossed the valley of death,
yep,
and starting down a commercialization path where they can see a big return on investment.
Yep.
But it's getting it to a point where it's actually in front of them that they will make that investment, and that's a long path,
yep,
from where the research was.
So, one of the disturbing things that's happened lately, I guess since the recession really, is that the amount of money being poured into basic science by the government has actually gone down about 3% across the board. And this is if you count even the medical research, NIH stuff and everything.
Yeah, and I think those numbers, might even be low. If you actually look at the trend, you know, from the 70s and 80s, it used to be 70% government funded on research and 30% private sector, and that's almost completely flipped now. I mean, the government is 20 to 30% of the funding of research and on a downward trend, which I think is a little bit disturbing.
I think that's incredibly disturbing as, you know, a member of an advanced society building the best tech. We need to do more of that. So my opinion is the government should be doing way more basic research and not less, and shouldn't be leaving it to the private sector. You share that opinion?
I do share that opinion, and I think it's certainly the case in the higher tech fields, and in this case, in the cybersecurity realm, because of the rapid pace of change of the technology and the innovation that's happening, I think it's even more important that we are putting more money into this to spur the innovation that needs to happen.
Okay, so we'll establish more basic research should happen at the government, but then we got that Valley of Death thing, and the question is whether the corporate world should be reaching back through the Valley of Death and pushing things along to the kind of VC-ready level. Should the private sector be doing that, or is that a government job too?
I think there's, you know, every technology is going to be a little bit different, and I think there are numerous models that you can use. In some cases, the government can help push that along depending upon the technologies where there might not be a big market. For example, in technologies to support law enforcement, which we worry about at DHS, that's not a big market. There's not going to be a lot of investors because that's not a, you know, generic IT solution that's going to be specific to law enforcement. So government has to put a little bit more money in there to make that more successful. But if it's, you know, generic IT kinds of things, then certainly the private sector should be reaching back and co-investing or even making some investments. And I think you're starting to see, you know, some of the critical infrastructure sectors and more you know, larger companies taking advantage of the government-funded R&D at an earlier stage than they have in the past.
Uh-huh. That's good. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. So let's switch gears a little bit. This is a slightly difficult subject. So academic computer security efforts, kind of like Fred Schneider's science of security stuff, are almost wholly disconnected with the kind of security operations center, network operations center, operational security mostly practiced in the government. Like, there's a world of difference between those things. Why?
So I think it's in large measure, you know, you can blame anybody you want, but I think in large measure it tends to be back to our conversation earlier about transition. You know, many of the academic researchers who are doing that basic science, that's what they want to do, and they're not worried about the transition.
Mm-hmm.
And so in large measure, it's up to the government to determine what things coming out of there have significant relevance and continue to fund them past the basic science and into the applied and the development and transition activities.
Well, let's talk about something slightly different. So I'm not thinking mostly about tech transfer. Instead, I'm thinking, why is the government sometimes missing the boat when technology has been transferred out that the government invented? but it's not being picked up by maybe the contractors or the subcontractors who are doing operational security. And so that sort of leaves the government behind, say, in security engineering or software security or any of the stuff I've been focused on for the last 20 years.
Yeah, and I think there's always this, you know, the government will oftentimes be an early adopter of some technologies from a test and evaluation perspective, but they seem to be a slower buyer from an acquisition perspective.
Uh-huh.
And that's, you know, that's an acquisition piece. But I think there is also this awareness piece that the government's not even aware of those technologies that are coming out of the academic space, but they still maybe are not mature enough to be into the commercial space. And that's where I think the government has a role, and one of the roles that DHS tries to play is, you know, I count on the National Science Foundation and the Department of Energy and other agencies who fund basic research,
yep,
to produce the outputs that I can use as inputs into the programs that we run.
Got it.
You know, we're not worried about basic science. We're worried about taking the, you know, somebody's already done 2 or 3 years worth of research. We know what the cool ideas are. Let's take them the next step. Let's carry them down the field another 10 or 20 or 30 yards,
mm-hmm,
towards commercialization and transition. And I just don't think we, the government, do enough of that.
No, it's kind of funny. It's kind of like, you know, the government makes some really nice, nutritious dog food and fails to eat it.
Well, and sometimes, you know, there's danger in doing that, too.
Yeah.
You know, if it's, and we're seeing, I think, more and more COTS products, certainly in the DHS perspective. We buy COTS. We're very rarely doing, you know, GOTS,
right,
government off the shelf,
right,
because it's not sustainable. You pay a lot more for something that is GOTS than you do for something that you can get in the commercial marketplace.
Yeah, that makes total sense. But then you end up, you know, with some contractors putting ridiculous cross-site scripting bugs that we could have found,
yep,
in our sleep automatically in the 90s. In fact, you funded research to make that stuff go away automatically, and yet the same department, you know, I guess the government's just so darn big, it's difficult.
It is, you know, again, some of the technologies that the government's buying is, you know, 5 to 10 years old.
Right, and that's an eternity.
That's right. We don't always, in this area, don't always put the bleeding edge technology into operation.
Yeah. Let's talk about open source for a minute. You've been,
sure,
a huge proponent of open source and security. And, you know, you funded a lot of open source stuff and caused a lot of people to build things that were then open source, which is pretty cool. But in light of the Heartbleed stuff and other spectacular failures in open source, are you still a big open source proponent? And what do you think we can do to ascertain the security of a piece of open source stuff?
So yes, I'm still a huge believer in open source. I think it's just another model, another avenue for getting the technology out there and commercialized. You know, I'm one of those that believes that open source doesn't necessarily mean it's more or less secure than proprietary solutions. I still believe there are places where open source is a good solution or better solution. Mm-hmm. As you know, we've had, you know, number of successes. I think our most successful activity in open source was the Suricata work with the OpenIDS IPS system that we funded back in 2007 to 2010,
mm-hmm,
and it's still out. And, you know, the key there was getting the vendors, you know, to take the code and put it into their product, and the licensing was favorable. So I think there's a number of avenues we need to think about to continue to make open source more useful. One is the licensing issue always trips people up,
yeah,
and you need,
yeah,
to make sure that's clear.
Yeah.
I think there is other things you can do. You may be familiar with our Software Assurance Marketplace, which is an open and available software testing facility that includes a lot of tools for software testing. And, you know, the Heartbleed was, you know, not a, it was a resource issue. It wasn't an intentional problem. And what I've discovered is more and more of the researchers just don't have the resources available to them to test their software,
right,
or don't want to take time. And I think, you know, so tools to help make things better so we don't have the Heartbleeds in the future is another piece where DHS is spending a fair amount of resources.
Yeah, and tools are important, but I always like to say a fool with a tool is still a fool.
that is true, and maybe a fool with a whole bunch of tools isn't quite as big a fool.
You're always such an optimist, Doug. I think it's the optimism you grew up with out there in the Val State areas. So you have a cyber PhD and many years of academic training. What are your thoughts about professional certifications? You ever thought about that?
Yeah, I think about it all the time. You know, that's all part of the educational piece, and I think we're woefully behind in our education and our training. We're seeing it now, and, you know, it's not just the U.S. Every country I've been to in the last 3 years, you know, every government is worried about their education and their training and their next generation of cyber professionals. Do we have to have certifications? I think certifications are good. I think they prove that people have some amount of knowledge. You know, are they the silver bullet to solve all of our problems? No. But, you know, I think it has to be part of the equation. Mm-hmm. And you have to, but we have to make sure that people, you know, have some basic skills, can work in the field, continue to get increase. I mean, this is not a field where you can just get your degree or get your certification and then stop. Technology is advancing so rapidly, you really have to stay, you know, buried in the area in order to even keep up. And but I think, you know, the professional certifications are just one piece of the puzzle, and I think they're good, and I think they're useful, as are, you know, just hands-on experience is another, you know, great way. And not everybody likes to get those certifications or thinks they're useful, but I still think, you know, there are plenty of things we have to show education and training going forward.
I sort of think about it like the medical domain. You know, we need some brain surgeons, we need some regular surgeons, we need some general practitioner medical doctors, we need some nurses, and we need a whole bunch of EMTs, way more. And those people have different levels of training, degrees, certifications, and so on. And in some sense, I think, you know, computer security is in the same boat.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that's a very good analogy for... you know, because we got people who need to be hardware specialists and network specialists and, you know, malware analysts, same kind of model. The question is, you know, how important are those certifications? And I suspect, you know, the medical field's had probably 100 years on us from where the cybersecurity is, and maybe in 100 years we'll be as mature as the medical field.
Yeah, I think we're still sawing off limbs with a saw,
yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
That kind of hurts.
Yes, it does.
Civil War surgeon level achieved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much.
So quickly discuss two or three of the programs you're currently funding now at HSARPA. I think your budget's now something like $70 million a year, is that right?
It's a little higher than that, but pretty close, yeah. Uh-huh. It's in the 80 to 90 range, but yeah.
That's great. That's a far cry from the, I remember, you know, being on your advisory board maybe 15 years ago when you just got started. 2003,
yeah.
Was it? Yeah, it was 2003.
Yes, it was, yeah.
And the budget was $7
yeah.
million. So that's a
yeah.
big change.
Yeah, we've grown the program, and it's, you know, we think we're doing some cutting-edge stuff, and we're, you know, having an impact. Not only locally, but globally, you know, doing a lot of work internationally. I think I would probably highlight three or four programs for you, Gary, that I think are key. One, as you know, is at the core of everything is software, and software vulnerabilities continue to plague us. We have a suite of programs that are being run in the software assurance area. You may have seen a couple of our solicitations that just came out last week on software static tool modernization project, where we're trying to up our game on the static tools, and another one in application security testing. And so I think, you know, at the core of everything is software. We still don't have good software development tools, you know, as well as they should be. It all ties into our model to use the software assurance marketplace. So I think, you know, that's a key piece for us. Software's at the core of everything. We need to try to do a better job in building better software.
All I have to say about that is hallelujah.
Yeah, and you know, Gary, it's still not enough, right? I mean, we could spend another order of magnitude in funding, and we still won't fix all the software bugs. But we really need more people paying attention to this, and more importantly, back to the education piece, we actually need to fix our educational system to be teaching this software security much earlier in the pipeline than we are today.
Yep.
So I think there's all kinds of things we can do to fix software.
Yep, I agree with all those things. Yep.
Yeah, I knew you would. The second area that I think is key for us is, you know, everything online is about identity. And we don't have good systems and solutions for identity management and to be able to tell, you know, who you are online. You know, the old cartoon of the 70s that says, you know, nobody knows you're a dog on the internet.
Yeah,
yeah. It's still valid. It's still true. And part of that identity is what would help us in the attribution piece for those people doing bad things online. And so there have been, you know, several analogies of, you know, internet driver's licenses and all those kinds of things that, but at the core of it, it's still an identity problem. Mm-hmm. And our ability to do that. So we've got some new work going on there on the identity side, hopefully be able to make some impact there. A third area that I would like to just focus on, I think, is this whole area of cyber-physical systems and the security of that and, you know, kind of Internet of Things, you know, more and more connected devices. You know, we're looking at everything from automotive security, medical devices, building systems, aircraft, et cetera, all of these things that didn't used to be connected but now are.
Yep.
And how do we, you know, build security into some of the future designs of these systems working with, you know, auto manufacturers and their suppliers? So I think that's a key area for us as we look at, you know, the security of the future, all these devices that are going to be out there. How do you make sure they can be protected and not compromised? And so I think that's another key area that we've just initiated a new program in last year and doing some interesting work. And our fourth one that I would just touch on is mobile security. So, you know, we're leading the department in trying to put, you know, mobile solutions into government. You know, we're not starting fresh. We're using commercial product. You know, the commercial market is so large, but the question is, how do we add some additional capability to make it useful, more usable by government, and still more secure? And so DHS is in a very leading position, and S&T is leading the department in this space and trying to push it out across the entire federal government. So I think, you know, mobile's here to stay, and we've got to make sure we've got security solutions that are acceptable to government that might be a little higher security than your commercial market would worry about, but we need to be thinking about that from a government perspective.
Yeah, very nice. Well, listen, you know, this has been a great conversation, and I got to say, your persistence doing this stuff over many years is greatly appreciated. So thanks for sticking with it, Doug.
Thank you very much, Gary. It's good to talk to you.
So I got one last question for you, which is a doozy.
Sure.
Who's the best all-around baseball player, non-pitcher, in the history of the game?
You know, that's a tough question, and I'm going to have to go with, because I'm an Orioles fan, I think it's got to be Cal Ripken.
There you go. That was quick. That was quick. You're quick on the draw. I know you're a baseball guy.
Well, I was debating between Cal Ripken and Derek Jeter, and I'm not a Yankees fan, but Derek was a great player, but I got to go with Cal.
There you go. Well, thanks for your time. It's been great.
Thanks so much, Gary. Take care.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The September-October 2015 issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is devoted to the economics of cybersecurity. The issue features our interview with European cryptographer Bart Preneel. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.